Okay, so let's get started here. So I presume all of you have turned in your project one. So some people who sent mail at the very last minute saying there was some problem with the auto grader, I have responded to all of these emails. So if you have still had any problem submitting it or some such thing, let me know. Okay. Few more things. There will be a homework out soon. Written homework, not an assignment. So keep an eye on for it. I will put it up on the course web page. And I am going to send out an email saying it's up. So make sure that you do receive my postings from the course mailing list. Okay, it will probably go to your EdLab account. Okay, that's one thing. Some of you asked whether you can get an early start on project 2, which will be the first real project. Okay, this was just a warm-up project just to get you familiar with C++. So we will make that available soon. If you want to start early, it's up to you. But there will be an official handout date, and then you'll have 2 weeks from then to finish it. So keep an eye on for it as well. Now, I just want to remind you to keep up with the textbook. Okay, we are already on chapter 6 here. So if you haven't really been paying attention, we have covered quite a bit of ground already. In around a month from now, we will have our only midterm exam, the first exam. Okay, we have an exam and the final. So we probably will do several more chapters before then. So don't wait until the last minute and you will have a whole lot of material to catch up on. Okay. The reason for homeworks, exercises in the class and discussions are to make sure you are following the material in class as well as keeping up with the reading. Okay. So just make sure you at least keep up with the course, otherwise you will fall behind very quickly. Because we cover quite a bit of ground in this class. Okay. So going back to what we were talking about last time. So just a reminder, we started a discussion of CPU scheduling. Okay, so I presented first come first serve, and then we looked at round robin and shortest job first. And we were discussing this multi-level feedback queue, and we couldn't finish the discussion. So a quick recap of what this is. This algorithm tries to approximate shortest job first. It basically tries to eliminate the drawback where you need to know the job length or the task length in shortest job first to do its scheduling. So the way you do this is by observing the behavior of the task, and you assume that whatever you have observed in the near past is going to be true in the near future. Okay, and so based on this assumption, you decide how to treat that job. Okay. Now sometimes your assumption may not be correct if the application suddenly changes its behavior, but the scheduler will adjust, as we noted. So very quickly, I already talked about this last time, multi-level feedback queue has some number of ready queues. Okay. And each has a priority given to it. Okay, and the priority decreases as you go down. Okay, and each queue also has a time slice associated with it. The highest priority queue has the shortest time slice. And the time slice doubles as you go to the each of the next level queues. Okay, so in other words, it's increasing exponentially. Within each queue, the scheduler does round robin. It's a priority scheduler. So it will always start whenever it needs to schedule a task. It looks at the highest priority queue. If it's non-empty, it picks the task at the head of the queue and schedules it. If it's empty, then you basically go on to the next one until you find a non-empty queue and schedule something. So you will never schedule a task from a lower priority queue unless all of the high priority queues are empty. Okay, because it's a strict priority scheduler. And within a queue, you will do round robin. Okay, once the task finishes, you essentially do round robin. And I talked about how CPU bound and IO bound jobs are treated in this system. Essentially, if a task uses its entire quantum or time slice when it is scheduled, it will drop down in priority. It has to go one level down. On the other hand, if it relinquishes the CPU before the time slice ends, you rise in priority. Okay? So as a result of this policy, CPU bound tasks keep dropping until they reach the lowest priority queue, and IO bound tasks keep rising until they are at the highest priority queue. Okay? In other words, the scheduler favors IO bound tasks over CPU bound tasks, and we said this is exactly what we want, because CPU bound tasks do short bursts of computation and go back to doing IO. Okay? While IO bound tasks do short bounds of computation and go back to doing IO, CPU bound tasks have long bursts of computation. So in order to not slow down short jobs, you just want the CPU bound task to run. It uses the CPU for a very short period of time, then it gives up the CPU, goes back to doing IO. Okay? And so that you want, so in order to allow IO bound tasks to make progress, to give them higher priority. Yeah, and CPU bound tasks are only serviced when there are no IO bound tasks. So one drawback of this scheme is you will still have starvation. Okay, if you always have some IO bound tasks which are in the high priority queues, the CPU bound tasks will not execute, and we will talk about how to address this drawback today. Okay, so that's the basic idea. Okay, now we'll do an example, but are there any questions on how this scheduler works, what it is trying to do, how it is approximating shortest job first? Any questions about MLFQ? This is the scheduler, as I mentioned, that's used in most Unix like operating systems. Okay, some variant of this. So here is a quick example. Okay, let's assume there are three jobs. Okay, length 30, 20 and 10. Okay. And context switch is ignored again. The top, so there are, let's assume, three queues. Okay, these are the three queues. Time slices, so this is the highest priority, that's the lowest priority. Time slices are 1, 2, and 3. Okay, so all these tasks arrive, they always join the highest priority queue. Okay, so what is going to happen? Let's say you run the first job. Then what? Sorry?
If you run your first job around Robin, they will use the time slice of 1 second. This is CPU based and
then dropping priority. Right. So time slice is 1. So you take the first job, run it for a second. Okay. All CPU bound tasks, not doing any IO. It's going to use up its entire second. Okay. And MLFQ will drop it to the next queue. Okay. And then it runs the next job. It will also run for a second. It's also up CPU bound. Okay, use its time slice, so it will drop. Okay, same thing happens to the third job. So after the first three quantum, this queue becomes empty, because all of the three jobs have dropped one level down. Okay. Now there are three jobs here, the same three jobs. So you pick the first one, okay, the one that that came in, and then you run it for a quantum. Here you get a time slice of 2. Okay, but again it's CPU bound, it's not doing any IO. So it's going to use up its entire quantum, okay, and then it will drop down. Then the second one, same thing happens, the third one. And then, so all three jobs have actually reached the bottom queue. And here, so the top two queues are empty. All the three jobs are here. So you continue to do round robin until the first job has basically gotten its 30 second of CPU time. And the second job has gotten its 20 and the third job has got its 10. Okay? So here is basically what is happening. Okay? So you just run job 1, 2, 3 and it drops here. Yeah, then it basically you run it here, and you run 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and so on until they finish. Okay, so this job is obviously going to finish in MLFQ first. So it finishes at time 32 if you actually do the calculations. Okay, then once that job is finished, job 1 and 2 still remain in this third queue. Okay, they are longer jobs. They need 20 and 30 units of CPU time, so they'll round robin among themselves until job 2 finishes at this time. Okay, and then job 1 stays in the queue until it finishes. Okay, so those are the completion times, and the wait time, as I mentioned, is simply the completion time minus the length of the job minus the start time. Your start time is 0, so basically this minus this is going to give you this. Okay, your question here, yes.
So if it breaks for IO, does it go back to the same queue it was in, or does it go to the one below?
Okay. So as I had mentioned, if it breaks on an I/O, you have probably given up your CPU time slice. So you will actually rise. You go one level up, not down. Okay. So this is what I was saying. If you basically use up your entire quantum, you will drop. If you don't, you rise. Okay, so I/O bound tasks will stay here or keep rising until they land up here. CPU bound tasks will keep dropping. Yes.
So there's nothing that will keep it in its current slice. If it's in two, there's nothing that will allow it to stay in two.
Yeah. There's nothing it'll you can do to stay in the middle queue. You'll always go higher or lower.
So if something uses exactly two time slices, it'll go down to four, and then to four, it'll only use two, so it'll stop and then go back up to two.
Yes. Yes, you can do that. Okay, so going back to now here the same example, but now with I/O. Okay, so three jobs, 30, 20, 10. Okay, but the first two jobs are CPU bound, but the third one does I/O. Okay, it does one second of computation, then the second time slice it'll always the second it'll always do an I/O, and it'll become ready again. Okay, for simplicity, we'll basically only assume two queues here, not one. Okay, so the three jobs come in, and the first one runs, it's going to drop, go there. The second one runs, it's going to drop, go there. The third one runs. Okay, the first time around, it gets a time slice of two. Okay, and as we said, it does 1 second of I/O every other second. So it runs for the first second, gives up the CPU. Okay, it starts doing I/O. Okay, so it is not going to drop, it will stay here. If there were more queues, it would have basically risen if it was in the middle queue. But it's already in the highest priority queue. So the third job is always going to stay here. Okay, but every second it is basically going to do an I/O. Yeah, so once it is doing I/O, you actually that queue becomes empty. So you go down here, starts running this job. And then the job 1, job 3 becomes ready again. In the next quantum, you will again start from the top queue. That job has appeared back in the ready queue. So you will run it again for give it a time size of 2. But after the first second, it goes back to doing I/O. Okay? So it gives up the CPU. So this queue becomes empty again. Okay? Then you go back to the first two jobs which are sitting here and then keep running them in round robin. Okay? Yes, question here. Is this clear? So here is basically what is happening. So one runs, then two runs, and then three runs, and then one and two go here. Okay, and then three continues here. Okay, but every other second, it is doing I/O, so you get to run one of these two jobs. Okay, until they all finish. Okay, is this clear? So the superscript here. Okay, I should mention what is notation. The superscript shows how much CPU time you have received. Okay, and the subscript should show how much is remaining, in some sense, after this. Yes. Question.
Why does 3 not drop in queue?
Okay. Why does 3 not drop in the queue, right? So, 3 has total CPU time of 10. Okay. First time you run it here, you get a time slice of 2. Okay. What does its behavior say? Behavior says, every time you run, you will do 1 second of computation, and then you start doing I/O. Okay, so you get a time slice of 2, you only use one of that 2 seconds, and then you go back to doing I/O. So our rules say that if you don't use your CPU time slice, you will rise until you reach the highest priority level. If you use the entirety of CPU slice, you drop. That's what MLFQ scheduler does. Okay, so 3 never uses its time slice because it always gets 2, and but it only uses one of those 2 seconds. That's what its behavior is. Okay? Is that clear? So that's the reason. So it's an I/O bound task, basically. So if the rules say that if you don't use your entire quantum, so you will be given, depending on which queue you are, you will be given a quantum duration or a time slice. If you don't use that time slice, you start doing I/O before you do that much computation, then you are going to rise. Okay, until you reach the highest. Otherwise, you drop. That's the rule for MLFQ. Any questions here? Is it clear what is happening? Okay. Okay, so I'm not going to do anything about wait times here. Just want to point out that you see that the wait time of MLFQ is actually shorter than round robin. I didn't show shortest job first here. As an additional exercise, you can see what shortest job first will do here. Okay? Because shortest job first has the minimum waiting times, and we said MLFQ is an approximation of shortest job first. So it's interesting to see how shortest job compared with MLFQ, how good an approximation is MLFQ. Okay, so you can actually do the same exercise, add one column to shortest job first and see what the completion and wait times are. Okay, and that will tell you how good, yes.
For the third job, the superscript increases by 2 every time. Why wouldn't it only go by 1 if it's only going for 1 second each time?
Here?
Yeah. Increases by 2.
Okay, so I think I didn't mention what it is doing. So this is the actual time that has elapsed, and so it's doing 1 second of computation and 1 second of IO. So this is at time 3.
Okay,
that's the way to read it. Okay, so here is the issue of fairness. Okay, so we said shortest job first has this problem where it can have starvation, okay, and so can MLFQ. And starvation in MLFQ will occur if the higher priority queue always has a job to run. The CPU bound tasks have all dropped to the bottom queue. Okay. Now if one of the higher priority queues is always has a job to run, the CPU bound tasks will never run. Okay, and they will starve in the system. So this can happen if, let's say, there's a CPU bound task in the higher priority queue, you run it, and it runs for a short period and starts doing IO. Just before it starts doing IO, another CPU bound task that was waiting becomes ready to run. So it comes to the highest priority queue. So you pick that task. Okay? And as it's running and about to do IO, yet another task becomes runnable. So you might have a lot of these IO bound tasks that become ready to run, and they starve out the CPU bound tasks. Okay? In shortest job first, the equivalent example is there is a long job waiting and a short job comes in and it gets to run, and just as about it's about to finish, another short job comes in. So this new short job has higher priority over the long job. So the short jobs will continue to run and starve out your long jobs. Okay, same thing will happen here. So question is, what can you do about this? Obviously you don't want a system where some tasks are going to starve. That doesn't work, because you want every task to make some progress. So what are some ways to do this? One is to give each queue a fraction of the CPU time. Okay, rather than doing strict priority, which is what we did. Okay, you give a fraction of the time, saying I'll run some jobs at the higher, at the top level queue for some time, and then I'll run jobs at the next queue. Okay, for some more time, and then I go to the next job, and then I cycle between these queues, and within these queues I do round robin. Okay, so you basically change the algorithm from being a strict priority to a more fair algorithm. Okay, yet another way to do this is to dynamically change the priority of the tasks. Okay, so going back to this old example. So if you have been in the lowest priority queue and you haven't gotten a chance to run for some period of time, then you could change and say you can actually go one queue up. Okay. So, and you keep doing this, and you will, if you have been starving for some period of time, your priority will rise. Okay, and you will actually keep jumping, hopping up one level up until you reach the highest priority queue. There you will actually get a chance to run, okay, by definition. Okay. So rather than just keeping all the CPU bound tasks at the bottommost queue, you can also say, if there is a task there that hasn't run for a while, let us actually move it back one level up to give it a chance to run, and so on. So you will never starve for long, because your priority will change and you will again rise until you get a chance to run. Okay, then if your CPU bound, you will drop again, and then if you starve, you keep rising. So this is basically a more dynamic priority scheme, and early versions of Unix essentially did this to ensure that the starvation problem goes away, and every task at least gets some CPU share, so even if it's a low priority or a CPU bound task. Okay, so there are solutions like this that you can use. Okay, now the problem here is when the system is overloaded, Okay? Essentially, that will cause all the jobs to keep rising. Okay? Because if it's overloaded, that means every queue has some job to run. So you will only run jobs at the highest priority queue, and that queue never becomes empty. So the moment you drop down, you will starve for some time and come back up. Okay? So you are in an overloaded situation, and you are not able to favor IO bound tasks, because every job is starving if it drops down, and eventually the scheduler will dynamically elevate its priority and bring it back up. Okay, so you are basically not being able to do priority scheduling and favor IO bound tasks. That's what is going to happen when you have overloaded systems. Okay, but yet it gets rid of this problem of starvation, but it makes the system more unfair. So the last scheduling algorithm, okay, it's actually an interesting scheduling algorithm. It's called lottery scheduling. Okay, this is all of the ones that we have talked about so far are deterministic schedulers. Okay, this scheduling algorithm uses a probabilistic mechanism. Okay, the way you schedule in lottery scheduling is every job, okay, when it arrives into the system, gets some number of lottery tickets. The tickets basically indicate what is the probability of you getting to run on the CPU as compared to other tasks in the system. Okay. So whenever the scheduler runs, it takes all the jobs in the ready queue, it takes all of its lottery tickets and runs a lottery. Okay. Basically, just think of it, you just put all of these tickets in a box and you pick a winning ticket. Okay. And the task that had this winning ticket gets to run next. So every time the scheduler runs, you will run a lottery among all the tasks in the ready queue. And the task that basically has the winning lottery ticket is going to get to run next. And it runs for some time, and then you will run another lottery and so on and so forth. Yes, question here.
Now, to determine which task is shortest job, is everything assigned once again off the bat, and then if a process IOs and doesn't complete time slice, then it's given more tickets?
Right. So you're asking, I just mentioned how it works. So the most interesting question here is how to decide which task to give how many lottery tickets. That's basically the same question you're asking. Now, in the scheme, you don't vary the number of lottery tickets dynamically. You just decide what the type of a job is, what it needs are, and you give it some number of lottery tickets. That is what it's going to run with. Okay. The system will not vary. So you'll see examples of how this works. Okay. But I just want you to think about how you can use the number of lottery tickets to vary the chances of a job winning the lottery, and as a result getting different shares of the CPU. Okay. So simply put, let's say there are only two jobs, A and B. Okay. The simplest scenario is where each of them is given a lottery ticket, and let's assume they are both CPU bound for now. Let's not worry about IO bound tasks. Okay. So what is the chance that A wins the lottery? Okay, it's half. And B is going to also win the lottery with probability half. Okay. So you will see that basically if A gets 50% of the CPU and B gets 50% of the CPU. Okay. Because every time you run the lottery, the chances of you winning are half. So you basically get to go every other time slot. Okay. Not deterministically, but probabilistically. So if you look at some time period, you will see that 50% of the time slices were won by A, and 50% of the time slices were won by B. Okay, because this is a probabilistic scheme. So by giving equal number of lottery tickets, you are basically giving equal share of the CPU. Okay. Now you could vary the number of lottery tickets and vary the fraction of the CPU you can get. So for example, if you give two lottery tickets to B and only one to A, then the probability that A wins the lottery is now going to be a third. Okay, and the probability that B wins the lottery is going to be two-thirds. Okay. So, in a probabilistic scheme, every three time slices, B is going to win twice. Okay, B wins twice as many lotteries as A because it has twice as many tickets. Okay. So, in a sense, if these are CPU-bound tasks, then A wins 33% of the time slots, okay, and B Then 66%. In other words, B has gotten twice as much CPU time as A, just by varying the number of lottery tickets. So what this scheme is doing is basically allowing you to vary or decide on the right number of lottery tickets to decide what fraction of the CPU should be given to that process. Now you can use this scheme to decide how many tickets to give to long jobs, how many tickets to give to short jobs. Within long jobs, do you want all of them to be treated equally, in which case you give them equal number of tickets, or should some long jobs be given more CPU time than other jobs, in which case you can give them more than others. Okay, so this scheme essentially allows you to partition the CPU time across jobs by varying the number of lottery tickets. Yes, you have a question.
When one of the jobs gets picked, does it lose a ticket?
No, you don't lose your ticket. You just basically, it's not like you give up the ticket because it's one. Every time you run, you basically run with these many lottery tickets. So whenever you run a lottery, you put two tickets into the hat from B, one from A, run the lottery. Okay, just because B got picked doesn't mean you give up that ticket. Next time you run, you still have two tickets. Okay, so that's just the number of tickets you can contribute to each lottery. Okay. Now, the nice thing about this algorithm is that it degrades gracefully as the load increases. So, for example, going back to our one and one scenario, okay, let's suppose a new process starts up, process C. Okay, and let's say you also give it a lottery ticket of one ticket. Okay. Now, what has happened is the probability that A wins the lottery is one-third, B is one-third, and C is one-third. So, in other words, you partition the CPU in the proportion 1:1:1. Okay. So everybody gets 33%. So you go down from 50 to 33. Okay, so you are degraded gracefully. So this is what you want, equal CPU time. Okay. And if D joins and you also give it one lottery ticket, then everybody is going to start getting 25% of the CPU and so on. Okay. So it is fair and it degrades gracefully. As you add jobs, everyone's share goes down in proportion to the number of lottery tickets they have, proportion to the total number of lottery tickets. Okay? Is this clear? So essentially, if a task has Li lottery tickets, the probability or the chances of you winning the lottery is Li over the total number of tickets in the system. Okay, that's essentially this ratio. That's also the fraction of the CPU time you are getting. Here you are getting one third of the CPU time. That's basically that time. Now, this is a randomized scheme, it's not deterministic. It is quite possible for A to win twice in a row or three times in a row. Okay, so just because there are two time slices doesn't mean A is only going to win one. It's probabilistic, it's a random draw. Okay? But over long periods of time, you will basically get CPU time in proportion to the number of lottery tickets you have. Okay, is this clear? Okay. So let's do an example. Okay, in this example, we will try to emulate shortest job first. Okay, and the way we will do this is we will assume that jobs are either long jobs or short jobs. Let's ignore I.O. for now. And if you want to favor short jobs, then you basically give them more lottery tickets. Okay, the way you favor a job is by giving it more tickets. The more tickets you have, the greater are your chances of winning the lottery. So short jobs get 10 tickets, long jobs get 1 ticket. Okay, in this particular instantiation of lottery scheduling. So if there is one short job and one long job, okay, and now let's assume both of these jobs are ready to run and each has one ticket, or rather not each has one ticket, but there's one long and one short, then the percentage of the CPU time that the short job gets is going to be 10/11. Okay, there are 11 tickets total, you get 10, so probability of winning the lottery is 10/11. This is also the fraction of CPU time you are going to get. That's 91%. Okay? And the percentage of CPU the long job gets is 1/11. That's approximately 9%. Okay? So you are essentially favored a long job because every time it's ready to run, you are basically picked with much higher probability than the long job. Yeah, because it has more tickets, it can win the lottery. So it will get it will be favored over a long job, if that's what you want. Okay. Now let's assume There are only long jobs, there are no short jobs in the system. Okay, there are two of these long jobs. So what's the percentage of the CPU time that each long job is going to get? Okay, it has to be 50%. This is basically two long jobs, each has one ticket each. We already did this, so this is 50%. Okay. Now if you had only two short jobs, no long jobs, still 50%. Each has 10 tickets. Okay, so you get 10:10, which is equal fraction. Each has the same number of tickets. It doesn't matter whether each has 1:1 or 10:10. It's the same thing. So you still get 50%. Okay? If you are 10 and 1, right, so here is, I'm just going to put this up. So here you have basically 10 over 101. Okay? Each job has 10 tickets. There are a total of 101 tickets. So the probability is around 10%. And there, the percentage of CPU time each long job gets is 1 over 101. Okay, so long jobs are essentially taking up most of the CPU time because short jobs are hardly getting anything. Okay? That's what you want if you give this tickets out in this ratio. If you have one short job and 10 long jobs, then the single short job gets 50% of the CPU. Okay, then the remaining 50% is carved out among the other 10, so each gets 5%. Okay, that's 1 over 20 tickets, here is 10 over 20. So you can actually vary the number of tickets and do many interesting things. You can decide what fraction each job gets. If it's a long job, how does it work? Short job, how does it work? And so on. Okay. Any questions here? Lottery scheduling, yes.
So would this scheduling algorithm be like about as difficult to implement as the shortest job first? Because you need some way to determine what actually is the shortest job before you can give out the tickets.
Right. So question is this harder to implement? So it's not hard to implement. Okay, implementation is just running the lottery. What is hard is now the problem has been actually taken out of the scheduler and put on the end user. Because somebody is assigning tickets. It's assumed that when you start a job, you also specify how many tickets it should get. If you don't know what the job is going to do or what to do, what to give it, and you give it tickets incorrectly, the behavior will not be what you expect. Okay? So the limitation, shouldn't say limited, the drawback of the scheme is that it assumes the user knows what he or she is doing in terms of assigning lottery tickets. The system isn't assigning tickets here. Okay, the user is assigned. System just says, you tell me how many tickets you want to give to this job, I'll run the lottery. Okay, so the user has to decide when the job starts up how many tickets to give it. Okay, yes, question there. So you're saying try to use lottery scheduling in a multi-level feedback queue and vary the number of tickets based on what it is doing? That yes, you could certainly, so that's not what lottery scheduler does, but you could certainly vary the number of lottery tickets based on what the job is doing. So we haven't really talked about I/O in this context at all. So for example, if you give a job a time slice, it wins a lottery ticket, you give it a time slice, it gives up the CPU before it time slice uses, then you can reduce its number of tickets or increase its number of tickets, thereby giving it more priority. On the other hand, if you use up your your time slice, you could reduce your number of tickets. That's what MLFQ does. Okay? Here, tickets correspond to, in some level, in some sense, share or priority or importance. Okay? So, you could have a scheduler that would vary the number of lottery tickets. Here, the scheduler is not doing anything with the number of tickets assigned in pure lottery scheduling. Okay? It's just saying, when the user decides what to do, I'll just run the lottery. But there is certainly, you could think of a scheme where one could vary that based on the behavior of the job. That was the question, right?
Yeah, and maybe that sort of solves the problem with the user thing.
Right. If you do that, but that predetermines what the policy should be, meaning that based on how you are varying the number of lottery tickets, okay, you have already implemented a policy in the system saying favor short jobs or favor long jobs. This is a more general scheme. this doesn't say that short jobs should get 10 tickets. I could say in my system short jobs get 1 tickets and long jobs get 10 tickets. In this case, I'm going to favor long jobs possibly at the expense of starving short job. So this general framework allows you lot more flexibility. Okay? But it requires you to decide how many tickets to give based on what criteria you want to achieve. Okay? This could do prioritized scheduling. So for example, if you are running Skype, for example, okay? Skype needs to run at high priority, otherwise you are going to get voice loss. Okay? So you could say Skype gets more tickets because whenever it wants to run, let it run so I get good voice quality on Skype. So I could do things like this. This the scheduler will never know. Okay? So here user is given control. But the user needs some knowledge on how to use this control. That's the problem. Okay, yes, you have a question.
Why does it use the vocabulary of ladders instead of just saying like set blank from a probability distribution?
Okay, why is it called lottery scheduling?
I mean, there was a
well, fun, but the original paper that described this called it lottery scheduler. So that's why the name is stuck. So they just basically say, there was a paper back in, I think, late 90s, where this scheme was originally proposed. And they said it's a randomized scheduler. The way to think about this is we run a lottery. It's easy to explain more than anything else. No, it's basically a randomized, think of it as a randomized scheduler. You basically toss a coin and your chances of winning depend on how many tickets you have been given. Okay, if it's a fair coin, everybody wins with the same probability. Okay, yes, you have a question.
You mentioned how it sort of needs to have decisions made for it in the sense of like what you want to prioritize. When you say you, do you mean the systems designer or the user?
So it's the user, because the user needs to has control here. So I mean, in some sense, if you don't specify how many tickets, the system could always have a default, right? If you don't say anything, I always start a job, I give it 1 ticket. So everybody is basically running with 1 ticket. So you get fair scheduling, which is you get 1/n fraction of the CPU. There are n tasks running.
So it's basically round robin.
Yes, it's going to do randomized round robin.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you now feel that B needs to be given higher amount of CPU or it needs to run at higher priority, you can increase its number of tickets. This is not different from even in current schedulers, right? Even on your existing system, you can vary the priority of a task. By default, the system runs everything at the same priority level. You could run NICE on Unix and reduce the priority or elevate the priority. Okay, that's when you decide that some tasks need to be treated differently. Same is true here.
If they're all the same priority, if you're doing a random walk, how do you know that all the processes will get reached?
No, you basically run a lottery every time, right? So you
yeah,
over long periods of time, if your random number generator is fair, it will have to pick one task every n.
So you have to make sure you have the random.
Yes. Okay, any other questions here? Yes.
Is this what basically like what they use now? It's like operating systems use like a modified version of this? Or?
No, operating systems don't use this. Operating systems use MLFQ or variants of multi-level feedback queues. Okay? But there are scenarios. So there are many. This is actually a family of algorithm. Okay? So lottery scheduling is a randomized version of what is called proportional share. You are essentially sharing the CPU in proportion to the number of tickets you have. There are many other algorithms that are more deterministic. Okay? So deterministic variants of these algorithms are in use, not by operating systems, but in other scenarios like if you have routers and switches, network equipment. Okay, they use deterministic versions of lottery scheduling, not randomized version. So if you say 1:1, they will deterministically split the bandwidth in the ratio 1:1 or CPU time and so on. So it is in use, but I don't know of anything that uses the randomized version. The deterministic flavors of these are actually used. Yeah, your question.
Why is
it not used in mainstream operating system? I'm not sure. I mean, there is a good precedent for using MLFQ because it is doing things automatically for you. by favoring IO bound and CPU bound tasks. Here you have to guess whether a task is going to be IO or CPU bound. And if you want good responsiveness, any system that needs to have good responsiveness, better favor IO bound jobs over CPU bound jobs. The reason for this is anytime you do IO, the user is foreseeing some output from the system or from that application, and you want output to appear quickly. That tells you that the system is responding quickly to you. Yeah, absolutely. So you could modify lottery scheduling by, if you modified the number of tickets dynamically, you are essentially going to do what MLFQ does. But MLFQ is doing that for you already. So why fix a problem that's not broken? Sorry?
You said MLFQ has fairness issues.
Yes, MLFQ does have fairness issues, but they have been resolved by tweaks like this. By tweaks like this, okay, which basically dynamically changes the priority. If you are starving, then you keep rising in priority until you get some share. Right. So you could have arguments with which is the best scheduler, right? So this is by no means a solved problem, right? So if you actually look at Linux, the default will be some variant of MLFQ. But Linux schedulers actually have deterministic versions of these already built in. You have to enable them, recompile the kernel, and you can use it. That, but by default, they have picked the scheduler based on their assumption of what they want. But that doesn't mean that you are forced to use it. You could always decide, I don't want it, I want some other scheduler. You go recompile the kernel, support is already there. And then there are other patches that, so we had at some 10 years ago, we had a version of the Linux kernel that implemented things like this. Okay, now none of that made it into the mainstream kernel, but people have implemented these and played around with them. Okay, so you could certainly change what you use in your operating system kernel. Okay, so this is the lottery scheduling. So quick recap. So the thing to take away, scheduling is not a solved problem. Okay, schedulers continue to change, continue to evolve as the needs change. Okay, even as recently as 2.6 version of the kernel, they rewrote the CPU scheduler entirely and changed what they wanted and so on. So I should mention that one drawback of lottery scheduler is that it does not work well in multi-core environments. It works very well in uniprocessors, but if you have multiple cores, the number of lottery tickets is not proportional to what you are going to get. Okay? Trivial example to show you what I mean is, let's suppose you have a dual core machine, okay, and you give tickets 1:2, okay, and you have two cores, and only two jobs. Okay? Scheduler is going to run on core 1, okay? Let's say this job B wins because it has more tickets, so B is running here. Okay, now your ready queue has only one task, okay, and A is going to win that lottery because A is the only task. So A gets to run on the other core, and the same thing is going to happen. So because you have two cores, okay, and there are two jobs, each job basically gets 50% of the total processing time, which is not what the lottery ticket suggests. The lottery ticket suggests that this should get 1/3 and this should get 2/3. But what you have essentially given it is 50-50. Okay? So lottery scheduling actually becomes unfair in multi-core environments without modification. Because what you get is not what the lottery tickets dictate. Yeah, because, yes?
Would that start to balance out a little bit if there were a lot more processes, or would it get more unbalanced?
Right. So question is, does it get better with more processes or imbalance? It depends on how the tickets are assigned. Okay, if there are certain assignments, you will always be unfair with respect to what the tickets tell you and what you actually get, regardless of the number of jobs. Okay? So there are problems like this that you cannot really address very easily. But in uniprocessors, this works really well. But that's a side issue. It's a research problem that how people are trying to figure out how to address these limitations. Okay? But coming back to the recap of scheduling algorithms. So we have looked at five. Okay, so first come, first serve, very simple, okay? Not fair. Round robin, which is fair, but wait times are not great. Shortest job first, optimal waiting times, but you can have starvation and it requires that you can predict the length of jobs. Okay? Multi-level feedback queues, which is basically an approximation of shortest job first, that does not require prior knowledge. And a randomized scheduler called lottery scheduling, which is fair, okay, but because it is randomized, you can only get good behavior over long periods of time. Over very short durations, depending on how the lottery tickets are won, you may not see any fairness. Okay, fairness is ensured over longer duration. Okay. Now, all of these schedulers have assumed so far, we never really discussed this issue of context switch times. All of our examples said, let's assume context switch times are zero. Okay. That's not true in practice, as we probably have seen. Okay. And you have to make sure your schedulers are using good time, good sort of context switch time, not context switch time, good quantum durations that amortize the context switch time. Okay, if your quantum duration is too short, you are wasting a lot of CPU time doing switching. Okay, if it's too long, then your system is not responsive. Okay, so this is an important issue in any scheduling algorithm, how to pick your length of the time slice. Okay, that's something to keep in mind. So we didn't say how do you pick it here, we just said what are general ideas on how to amortize it. It shouldn't be too small or too high. So that is basically the end of our discussion on CPU scheduling. So now we are going to go and start talking about synchronization. So when we talked about this notion of cooperating processes, shared memory and so on, we said that to implement correct versions of problems like producer-consumer, you need synchronization. And when we talked about threads, we said threads have access to global data structures, and you want to ensure that accesses to global data structures are done in a way that one thread doesn't trample on the data structure when some other thread is accessing it. Okay? So the way to address all of this is through this framework called synchronization, which involves semaphores, locks and monitors. These are the concepts we'll learn in this chapter. But just to give you an example of what might go wrong when you have concurrency or when multiple tasks are working on the same problem, here is this problem of too much milk. Okay? So the basic issue is example is as follows. So let's suppose that you and your roommate share a dorm room. Okay? So you come home from your class, you look in your refrigerator and you are out of milk. Okay? So you say, let me go get some milk. So you will go to the grocery store. Okay? While you are gone, your roommate arrives, okay, and looks in the refrigerator, okay, and there is no milk. So your roommate says, let me go get some milk. Okay? So and while your roommate is actually looking in the refrigerator, you have actually arrived at the grocery store, you bought some milk and you start returning home. And around the same time, your roommate has actually decided that it's her turn to go buy milk. So you arrive home, you put the milk in the fridge, your roommate has just left for the grocery store. She goes, buys milk, comes home, and you have too much milk. Okay. So this is basically the problem of synchronization. You did not coordinate with your roommate. You decided to do something without letting your roommate know what's happening, and you ended up with too much milk. Okay. Could have the opposite problem of not any milk. You may decide that there's no milk, and you will decide your roommate is going to go get milk and you go out to the gym or some such thing. Your roommate thinks it's your turn and you have no milk either. Okay, that's also a bad problem, but let's solve the too much milk problem. Okay. So this is what might happen. So although this looks like a real life example, if you have two threads that were working on some task, okay, the same thing can happen where thread 1 runs, it makes some decision, and whatever is blank time here is, think of it as your context switch happens, and thread 2 starts running and then it does something, and then you come back here and then both threads have made the wrong decision. Okay. So let's try to solve this problem. How do you go about doing this? Okay, so I'll introduce some terminology and then we'll try to address how can you write multi-threaded program that solves this milk problem. Okay? So when we use the term synchronization, we basically mean the use of atomic operation to ensure cooperation between threads or cooperating processes for that matter. Okay? And we'll see what atomic operation means here. Okay? When we use the word mutual exclusion, what we will mean is that only one thread is doing a particular activity at any time, and that thread is excluding other threads from doing that activity. Okay? So it's excluding other threads. Only one thread can do that activity in any given time. Okay? Very related to the problem, to the issue of mutual exclusion, is what is called a critical section. A critical section is a small piece of code in your application that only one thread can execute at any given time. If some thread is already executing that piece of code and another thread wants to execute the same piece of code, it will have to block, okay, in a critical, for a critical section. And the way it will block is this, through this mechanism called a lock. Critical sections will be protected by locks. Okay, this is abstraction that prevents another process from doing something. Okay, if you lock something and another process try to get the lock is in use, so you don't get the lock, you have to block. Okay? So you should always protect the lock, or rather protect the critical section with the lock. So you lock, acquire the lock before entering the critical section or accessing a shared piece of data. And you should always unlock when you leave the critical section or whenever access to shared data is done. Okay? And if the lock is already in use, you have to block. This is the basic idea of how you are going to do synchronization. Okay? Now, we should look at several examples to understand how all of these ideas are actually implemented in practice. Okay? So, the basic idea is to ensure coordination, and which is in this case synchronization, and that's going to involve some waiting. Okay? So, let's come back to too much milk. So, if you want to solve this problem, what are the correctness properties? Okay. Correctness properties is whenever you are out of milk, only one person should buy milk. Okay. If more than one buys milk, then you have too much milk. And the other correctness property is that someone should buy milk if you need it. Okay. Meaning, if nobody buys milk, that's going to ensure the first property. Okay. But that doesn't give you a satisfactory solution. Is this clear? So the first property, okay, in the context of any multi-threaded or distributed system is called a safety property, okay, or rather it's called a liveness property. The second property is called a safety property. So one thing, well, the first property ensures that something good happens, okay, which means that one person buys milk. Second property also ensures that nothing bad happens, which is someone should buy milk. If nobody buys milk, then you're out of milk. Okay. Now here is a solution to the problem you just mentioned. The solution is, let's leave a note, okay, and let's look at if there is a note before you make a decision. Okay, and so you don't buy any milk if there is a note. So here's the piece of code. Okay, so you say, if there is no milk in my refrigerator and there is no note in the refrigerator, then you leave a note, okay, you go buy some milk, and then you come and remove this note. So in this, now rather than people, we'll have threads doing this. So thread makes the decision, and thread B is doing essentially the same thing. Okay, you check if there's milk in your refrigerator, okay, and if there's no milk and there is no note, you leave a note, you go buy milk, and you remove a note. Okay, question is, will this piece of code achieve what you want? Will it give you those two properties? Yes, somebody said no. Is that you? Okay. Yeah. Yes. So what?
Because when a thread A and B hit the it at the exact same time.
Yes. Okay. So first, let's assume this is uniprocessor. Everything becomes more complex if you have multiple processors. Okay, on a uniprocessor, only one thread can run at any time. Okay. So that should be clear. So let's assume the scheduler picks thread A to run. Okay. So thread A comes and it actually checks this condition. Okay. Is there milk in the fridge? Okay. No. Is there a note on that fridge? No. Okay. So the if evaluates to true. Okay. So as soon as it's checked this if, let's say its time slice expires. Okay. So it has to give up the CPU. Time slice over. Okay. Now thread B runs. So it has basically, it's entered the if, but it hasn't done anything yet. Okay. And its time slice. So when it resumes next, it's going to start here. Okay. Now B runs. Okay. So B is going to check, is there milk? No. Is there a note? No, because A has basically been contexted just before it actually leaves a note. But it's checked this, but it hasn't done this yet. Okay. So A, B is also going to get this if condition to evaluate to true. Okay. So B is going to go in, leave a note, buy milk, okay, and then before it does anything, let's say it context switches out. Okay. So then A is still in here. Okay, when it resumes execution, so it's also going to go buy milk. So essentially, you are back to the same problem where you have too much milk. Okay, and this, the reason you had this problem is because you have context switches. Okay, so you have to assume that any process, any thread can be context switched at any point in time. The solution will be correct only if you can, you will get only one container of milk, no matter in what order A and B run. Okay, you shouldn't have to impose an ordering because the scheduler can run them in any arbitrary order. It can context switch them at any point in time. Okay. Despite doing this, if you come up with a solution where you only end up with one container of milk, then that's the correct solution. In any other scenario, you will have an incorrect solution. Okay, so this is an example of an incorrect solution to the too much milk problem. Okay, is it clear what happened here? Why this doesn't work? Yes, no. Yes, question.
Would the way to fix it be to make the whole if statement like its own atomic section of code that has to be executed at the same time?
Yes, so you're asking if this should be an atomic section. Answer is yes, but we are jumping two solutions down. Let's look at one more just to understand whether it will work. Okay. So here is another solution. So here now you can decide to have labeled notes. So you have a green post-it note and your roommate has a red post-it note. Okay. So what you will do is you will basically leave a note, because this is a code. Okay. You leave a note saying, I am A, I am leaving you a note. Okay. Then you check, is there a note? Okay. If there is no note, then you check, is there any milk? If there is no milk, you go buy milk. If you leave a note and you actually find another note, so if this if becomes false, then you simply remove your note. You assume that B is already gone to buy milk because there is a note, so I just take my note off. Okay. B does the same thing. Okay. It basically leaves a note. It says, is there note A? Okay. If there is note A, then it assumes that there is basically A has gone to buy milk. So it just goes here and takes a note off. If there is no note, you go and check, is there milk? If there is no milk, you buy milk. If there is milk, there's nothing to do. So you come here and take the note off. Okay? And then you go buy milk. Okay, yes?
For these examples, we're sticking strictly to one processor, one CPU.
Yes, one processor. Yes, question.
So this doesn't work because if you leave a note A, and then you context switch, and then B leaves a note, then you're stuck with no milk.
Yes. So this is going to have the opposite problem. Okay, this is not, you will not end up with too much milk in this case, but you may end up with no milk. Okay, because you may have a scenario, okay, where A runs, it leaves a note, okay, and then it context switches out. Okay, B runs, it leaves a note. Okay, it checks whether there is a note. A has already left a note, so it says A is going to go do something. Okay. And then before it does anything, before it takes out its note, it context switches out. So A runs here again. Okay? B still has left, not taken his note off. Okay? So it's going to check, is there a note there? Okay? Answer is yes. Okay? Then you say, okay, B is going to do it. You take the note off. Okay? And this cycle is going to continue. Okay? Both A and B leave notes. They see that the other has left a note. They assume that the other person is going to buy a milk. They take their note off. And then you can continue like this and you will never get any milk. If you're stuck in this cycle, yes.
Why not have the note say who put it there?
Yeah, so you have a note A and a note B, so you know who did leave it here. These are labeled notes, not.
Yeah, but if it reaches a note that it put there, then it won't.
Yeah, so you leave a note. This algorithm is slightly, you have to understand how it works. You leave a note, and then you check if the other thread has left a note. Okay. If it has, then you just say that person is going to buy milk. That thread has already left a note, so you just take your note off. Okay. So this is the scenario where you come and see that my roommate leave a note on the fridge, and if you see that note, you assume the roommate is going to buy milk. So you basically both leave notes, then you both take the note off based on in what order you check things, and then you assume the other person is going to do it and vice versa. Okay. So this doesn't work either. Okay. This program doesn't have the problem of too much milk, but it makes no progress towards the goal of buying one container of milk. Okay, so again, you have a problem. So the second condition is violated here. The first, not the first one. Okay. First one is not violated. The second problem. Someone buys milk if you need it, doesn't work in this case. Okay. So here is yet another variant. So this one, there are two different pieces of code that A and B execute. So A is going to leave a note, okay, and then it checks whether B has left a note, and if so, you just loop there, you just wait. So this is the equivalent of, I leave a note, I see a note on the fridge that B has left, and I'm going to just stand near the fridge, not go away anywhere. Okay, so I'm just going to do nothing, I'm just going to wait there, okay, until that note goes away. Okay. Once that note goes away, I can actually check if there is any milk in the fridge. If there is milk, then I don't have to do anything. If not, I'll go buy milk and I'll take my note off. Okay, that's what A has done. B has basically left a note and is just checking. This is the same thing as the previous. B's code hasn't changed. It's the same as this code. Okay. B basically left a note and has A left a note. If not, I go check if there is milk. If not, I go buy milk. I remove my note. The okay, question is, will this work?
I'll say what I think.
Yeah, one person thinks it's going to work. What do the rest of you think? Okay. So if you actually look at all possible interleavings, okay, no matter when you context switch, no matter when you run, you will actually see that this code actually works. Okay, you will end up with milk in your fridge at the end of this. Okay, and there is an argument on the next slide as to why it will work. Okay, so you basically say at some point in time, either there A has left a note or not left a note. If A has not left a note, then it's safe for B to check and buy milk if needed, because A has not yet started. If A has already started and left a note, then A is going to go check. Okay, because there is, it's waiting here. So the real life example of this is, you come to the fridge, you see that B has left a note, and you stand there. Okay, if eventually B comes and takes the note off, you then open the fridge and say, did B actually buy, or it just took the note off and took off? Okay, and if you just took off, then you go buy milk. That's basically what's happening here. Okay, so you basically can convince yourself that this will work. Okay, but that said, you have to pay some attention into A and B. So this works for two threads. If you have three threads, then this may not work. Okay, because it's more complicated. So you will read this argument, you will understand why it will work. But the problem with this approach is that it's way too complicated. Okay, so first of all, to write this code requires you to do a lot of thinking. I just put the code up, but if I told you to write it this way, you will have to try, understand, convince yourself that this is actually going to work. Bigger problem is it is asymmetric. Okay? A, the code that A runs and B runs are different, and this may only work for a case where there are two threads. If you had n threads, then for every value of n, you may have to come up with a different solution, a different scheme that works for 3, 4. Whether you can come up with a scheme that works for arbitrary number of threads is not clear. Okay? Yet another problem, okay, which is I think an important problem, is you are busy waiting. Okay? A is just sitting there in a loop, doing nothing. Okay, the equivalent of, you have to stand near the fridge to make sure your roommate actually comes back with milk and just doesn't take the note off and leave. Because you cannot do anything until your roommate comes back. You're just waiting. Okay? Not useful. Okay, basically, in this case, you're looping, so you're actually consuming CPU resources. Okay, you're just sitting in a loop waiting for that note to go away. Okay, so it's not very useful thing to do. Okay, yes, question.
Wouldn't it be possible for it to both leave a note and then definitely
just like staring at notes.
Yeah, you could do that, but then both will start busy waiting, which is, the problem is not just the correctness, which is, this is correct, it's asymmetric, it's hard to understand, but the other problem is, if you just start to sit there looping, then you are consuming resources, system resources, you are basically sitting in a loop, consuming CPU cycles, and that's not good. You can actually come up with solutions where, if there is nothing to do, you block, rather than doing busy waiting. Busy waiting tends to be bad in terms of consuming CPU cycles.
So I was saying, if they were just both in the loop waiting for the note to leave, wouldn't that?
B doesn't have a loop.
Oh, okay.
No, B is not, yeah. The B is using the same code as solution 2, only A has changed. That's why I'm saying it's asymmetric. What A does and what B does are two different things. It's hard for you to convince yourself it works. Okay, but you can after some effort. Okay. So you want a better way to solve this problem. Okay, we come up with a solution, but we don't like it. Okay? And this is where synchronization comes in. Okay? So there are primitives that you can use to ensure that any code that is protected by this primitives will be only executed by one thread and only one thread at a time. Okay? Any other thread that wants to execute that piece of code has to block. If you are given such primitives, then it is much simpler to solve synchronization problems, as we will see. Okay? There are three primitives we are going to talk about. Okay, today I am only going to talk about the first one, but in the next class we will do two more. Okay? So locks, semaphores, and monitors. Okay? If you have done Java programming and have used any synchronizations, okay, then you have used monitors. We will come back to this when we come to monitors. But they all do the same thing, okay, but with different abstraction. So lock, as the name suggests, is basically you lock a piece of code, and while you lock that piece of code, nobody else gets to execute it. Okay? Semaphores are a generalization of locks, which we'll look at. And monitors are a higher level construct that use locks internally. Okay? And we'll see all of these require some hardware support and involve waiting. Okay? So let's just start with the notion of a lock and understand how this works. Okay? So lock provides mutual exclusion to a critical section or access to shared data. Okay? If you want to protect any piece of code such that only one thread gets to execute it, you have to wrap it with a lock. Okay? So before executing that piece of code, you have to do an acquire of a lock, and after you're done executing, you have to release the lock. And what lock acquire does is, if the lock is free, the first thread that calls acquire gets hold of the lock. Okay, and it gets to go in and starts executing. If anyone else does lock acquire before this thread has released the lock, then it will block at that point. It will have to wait, okay, because the lock is currently in use. Okay, that's basically, so it has to wait its turn. Okay, so rules for using a lock, always acquire the lock before entering a critical section or before you share access any shared data. You release it after you are done. And the lock is assumed to be initially free, meaning you initialize it saying it's free. Yeah. So here is a too much milk problem with locks. Okay. So each thread will first do a lock acquire. Okay. Then you just say, if is there milk in the fridge? If not, go buy milk, and you release the lock. Okay. So very simple, two lines of code that is protected by lock. This is what we will call a critical section. Only one thread should be doing this at any given time. Okay? So now this is very clean, and we'll see it's very easy to understand. Okay? So now it doesn't matter who runs in what order, where you get context, none of that matters now. Okay? The reason for that is you go and do a lock acquire. The first thread that goes does a lock acquire is going to get hold of the lock. Okay. Beyond this, it doesn't matter who gets context switch. Because you get a lock, okay, you get to go in and start executing the critical section. So let's assume A runs first, it gets hold of the lock, and it has actually entered the critical section. Okay. Now let's assume, like we had assumed in our first solution, that A is going to give up its time slice. Okay. Its time slice expires, and A is context switched out. Okay. But it is still holding the lock. It hasn't released it. That's the important thing. So B is going to run, and it's going to go do lock acquire. Okay? Then you see that the lock is actually in use. Okay, if the lock is in use, what this is going to do is this function is not going to return. Okay, basically, this function is going to block until the lock is released. So you never return from this function. You're just sitting there waiting for the acquire to return. So this thread cannot make any progress at this point in time. Okay. So you will basically block. Because law is, so as soon as you block, then you have given up your CPU. And at some point A is actually going to run. It is inside the critical section. So it is going to go check milk. If there's no milk, you go buy milk and then you release the lock. Okay? Now at some later point, as soon as you release the lock, at some later point, B is actually going to acquire the lock because it was waiting for the lock. Okay? So as soon as it acquires the lock, now it gets to go into the critical section. So then it's going to go check if there is milk. But if A has released a lock, it's guaranteed that it has bought milk if there was no milk. Okay. And if there was milk, then there was nothing to do. So you would have just exited. So when you come here, this condition will no longer be true if A has already run before you. Okay. If either there was already milk, so A did nothing. But if there was no milk, A has already bought milk. So you will basically go check that there is milk and you release the lock and you're done. Okay. So it doesn't matter how context switch work. You don't have to worry about timing, nothing. You just protect this with a lock. This is guaranteed only one process can execute, one thread can be executing this. So there's no need to worry about other thread doing something bad. Okay? And your code works. So this is how you would use synchronization to get rid of all of the problems we talked about. Okay? Is this clear? Any questions here? Now all of the magic is actually happening in these functions. Okay, these are not trivial functions. We are actually going to see what this function is doing for us. Okay, because it's operating systems class, so we need to know how an operating system has implemented a lock for you. Okay, so that's where we are going to spend some time. So we are. So I'm going to just introduce this notion of hardware support, and we'll resume this discussion next time. So to implement locks is now where the problem is, because you solve the application writer's problem. From an application writer standpoint, life is great. You just use locks and everything works. Okay? But now all the problem is being shifted back to the operating system. It has to now implement these locks to ensure atomicity. Okay, how does it do that? So to do this, you have to actually rely on underlying hardware. Okay, this is not going to come very easy. So the underlying hardware has to guarantee you that loads and stores are atomic, okay, which they are, because loads and stores is single instruction, they're always handled atomically. The hardware needs to support this notion of disabling interrupts, and we'll see how to implement a lock by disabling interrupt. And the hardware may optionally also have instructions that do things atomically. So there's an instruction called test and set instruction that not only checks the value of a variable, but it also flips the value of a variable in one instruction. Okay, rather than saying if something do something, which is two instructions, it will test and set in a single instruction. This gives you atomicity. Okay. So next time, what we are actually going to do is see how you actually implement the acquire function and the release function using these hardware primitives. Okay, so that will tell you what actually is happening inside this function. Okay, so let's just stop here for today. So we'll talk next time.